is Mary Virginia McCormick Pittman Waller, a long name, but I have to satisfy and honor both sides of my family. So when I had different nicknames along the way, depending upon what charity that we're serving at the time, etc., with the military. And so therefore, but my name is Mary Virginia, and I had been nicknamed by the soldiers as MVP. So that's a very lovely nickname, but I have to really hard to be sure that I live up to that name. If I'm with the Native Americans that I work with, they have different nicknames for me as well. So with the Cheyenne, I am called the Noble Eagle. And if I am with the Sioux, they call me Spirit of the Wolf. Don't you just love that one? But at any rate, here today, we're talking about history and families and what history does and what your family does to help to create human beings that have compassion and responsibility, not only for their own family, but also the global family. So I think that is what I am supposed to share and express with you today, is how those things come about and how important it is to pay attention to it with a young child's life.
My name is Dr. Charles Gentry. I am currently 48 years old. Today's date is December 2nd, 2022. We are in San Antonio, Texas, in Alamo Plaza. And I am in conversation with my colleague, Mary Virginia McCormick Pittman, also known as MVP, and a few of the other nicknames that she's shared with us. And as colleagues, we just met earlier this year, and she's told me so many wonderful stories that I thought it would be great for us to share here with StoryCorps for the record. And MVP, I'm going to ask you the first question, and that's to describe one of your philosophies of life.
Well, I think that having lived as long as I have at this point, I probably have several philosophies, but I think that one of the most meaningful one to me is the act of giving. To give the giving is such a virtue, and it brings on kindness, it brings on understanding. It is very healthy, not only for the person that is giving and the person that you're helping, or maybe the organization that you're helping with what you're doing to give. It's an important, it's a virtue that God has given us, and I think it's one of the most important virtues that we have access to if only we use it and live it. And so I feel like that giving, and giving is something that you do not from the pocketbook. Giving is something that comes from the heart.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I know that you have been quite generous in making contributions to causes both here in San Antonio and in Houston. And we'll talk more about some of those causes that you've supported over time. But I'd like for you to tell me more about your father, Dr. James E. Pittman, MD, was chief of staff and head of the Department of Surgery at Herman Memorial Hospital in Houston for a number of years. And he was also a colonel during World War II, where he was a chief surgical consultant in Europe. And he was in Normandy. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his valor during the Battle of the Bulge. Can you tell me more about his influence on you and your worldview?
Yes, indeed. I'm very proud of my father, and I'm very proud of being his daughter. But I think probably I should start with the entire family. Mm-hmm. Is that my entire family were filled with medical people and civic-minded people. So it taught me from the very beginning in life, and I will share how that came about, but the very beginning in life, in that it was not just my community that I lived in and where in Texas I lived, what have you, but that the responsibility and the feelings had to extend into the global family. and the global family meant including animals as well as the ecology of our entire world. And I'm grateful for that. But now I think we're going to talk about how that came about.
That's right.
And it was interesting things. My father and my mother both were both very attended to civic duties. However, they both were naturalists. They both loved animals and they both loved nature. So therefore, at a very young age, when I was very young, probably at my father's knee, he began to teach me about nature. He taught me how to fish. He taught me how to hunt. He taught me how to understand and appreciate animals and how important they were, especially the apex predators, and how they made the balance between flora and fauna all over the world. So I learned that at such a young age, and how many children know about things like that? And he was very convincing. And also, he showed me in his own way how those things worked. So I was very inquisitive and learned very quickly about how important nature was to all of mankind.
Well, I know that was a real profound impact that your father's influence had on you to care for wildlife conservation and the animals of the world. I know he also had an important influence on your relationship to our military and our veterans, the wounded warriors. You are the founder and CEO of MVP's Welcome Home Wounded Warriors Initiative, which is dedicated to the mission of serving the wounded warriors. Can you say more about the promise that you made to your father and how you are living that out?
3 months before my father died, he told me, he said, "Hon," he said, "you're going to have to take care of the soldiers now when I die." And I said, "Daddy, how is this little redheaded girl going to take care of the military, et cetera?" And he said, "Well, you just pray to God about it and you'll come up with an answer." And so I did. And I went to see the general. It's a good, cute story. I went to see the general out at Brooks Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. And he didn't know me from Adam. But I had arranged it that a friend of mine who was an officer arranged the meeting for me with him. And he did accept the audience for me to have the meeting with him. So I spoke to him about an hour, what my thoughts were on the subject and what I could do personally to be of service to our veterans when they came back from war in regard to their healing processes, as it were. So the man listened to me very nicely for 1 hour. And when we finished, he looked at me and I looked at him and I'm waiting to have the answer. And there's no answer coming forth. And I'm inside, I'm thinking, oh no, he's going to turn me down, what have you. And then he looked at me a little bit longer and he said, "You know what?" He said, "I don't think you can do it." But he said, "You're so compassionate about our military men. You have such a heart for them." He said, "I'm going to give you a go at it." The rest is history.
And that's how you got your nickname MVP is?
Well, I got the name MVP from the soldiers themselves. They never knew my name, my full name. They just were the soldiers and I was with them and doing what I was doing. And they made up the nickname and they said, "Well, you are our MVP." Because I guess they were liking what I was sharing with them and what I was entreating them with, because you have to gain their trust. That's the secret to success, because the idea was to help them, to service them and their families in such a way that they would put aside depression and begin to reconnect with the tapestry of the American social system again and go out and be maybe a different kind of man, but even so, an even better kind of man. And that was very humbling to me. And that meant that I had to have a great deal of humility as well as passion. And they knew that I meant business. And I let them know that whatever we were up to and whatever we were doing, they were not alone, that I would be with them. I would jump in the foxhole with them, and we're going to come out. We're going to take a step at a time, but we're going to come out of this together. And it's the word togetherness that created, I think, the wonderful things because of listening, because they knew that I was not going to let go. I was not instructing them or giving them direction. I was with them in the melee, in the feeling of the sadness, in the depression, in the stories that they told me. And at the same time, how are we going to come through this and come out into the light from a lot of darkness? And the stories I have heard were just absolutely chill you to the bone. But they knew they could trust me. And they knew that when someone who understands hears these stories, that is when we could come forward together. And by the grace of God, that is what began to happen. And I worked with 370 transitional soldiers that were all candidates for suicide. And thank you, God, working with that for X number of years in Hawaii, that at least three and a half years, what have you, we never had a suicide on our watch. And I was grateful for that. And I did not have to deal with the army in the sense of having to deal with other doctors or those. I had my own situation I had to answer to an admiral or a general, and then I dealt with a colonel in the field. But otherwise, I had my own realm, which I worked with. And so to tell a story to perhaps give someone a feeling of what it really means in that point in time to take care of our wounded soldiers is that at the time we were having a large party at Brooke Army Medical Center and band and dancing and rewards were being given. And that night I had been honored by receiving from the Army, signed by the Surgeon General of the United States Army, that I was made with distinction, a member, an actual member of the United States Army Corps and Regiment without uniform. And while we were doing all of this and having this wonderful night with all of the potentates that had been invited, all of the different official officers, with the enlisted men, families, all, it was just a beautiful night. And everyone was happy and enjoying it, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, the general, this was toward the end of the program though, but the general suddenly ran up to the microphone and band stopped, everything stopped to hear because we knew it was something we had to hear right now. He got on the microphone. It makes me want to cry because I remember it so distinctly. And that was, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is the end of the night. We have three cargo airplanes that are flying in from Germany as we sit here with wounded soldiers that have to be attended to immediately to save their lives." And he said, "So everybody is now on duty." And with that, he said, "And blessings upon those that are coming in and blessings upon you who are going to go to attend to them and save their lives." And with that, he said, "Good night." Wow. I will never forget that. It was so dramatic. And it was so immediately, everybody just swarmed because they knew what they had to do to go and save that human life.
Wow. And that's one very dramatic story about a homecoming. You've also had some stories that you've told me about homecomings that really made those soldiers feel welcome once again.
Oh, yes. That was one when I'm still remembered about that one because this little old girl from Texas decided it was not good enough when we were having the 25th come back from war and where they had been in Iraq, et cetera, for X number of tours of duty, which were pretty violent, to say the least. And so they were bringing them in by three cargo planes at different stages of X number of days. And so I was there in Hawaii at the time. And so I was trying to do my part as best I could and what could I do, et cetera. And so I said, well, what are we going to have to have this wonderful opening, this wonderful time to let them know, welcome home, welcome home. And they said, oh, we're going to feed in some recordings. I said, you're going to feed in music to them, and they're coming and getting, they will have been in the cargo plane for 48 hours, and you're going to feed in music? And I'm talking like this. I'm, you know, here the civilian here, but I'm talking to all of the main potentates like that. And they said, well, yes. And I said, no, we cannot do that. And they're looking at me like, what is she going to say next? And I said, you know what? We're going to have a band here, a 22-piece band, and we're going to have flags, and we're going to have balloons. And I'm talking, you imagine me talking to generals like this, what have you? But I was that adamant about it because I was really upset. They had been on these tours of duty for that long. When they came back, they were suffering. We needed to show them, welcome home. We're glad you're here. We got a hold of your lives, you know? And so consequently, that got a name for myself, but it turned out to be a good name for myself because I had had a general back home in San Antonio to promise me whatever I needed for our soldiers, he would help me get it. I remembered that promise. And so I went back to him and I said, I need that band, that 323rd. I said, I need that 22-piece band over here to welcome the soldiers. He couldn't say no. So we had our band came all the way from San Antonio, Texas over there. So that when those planes came in, and we also had it arranged that there were any families that were there around the base or lived there, that they would be able to come in, bring their dogs and everything. So when they got off the airplane, they had to be vetted in a certain area. So everyone was quiet in the area where we were, which is like a big auditorium. And after they were vetted, then they opened the screen and they let them come through. When that happened, to this day, I never forget the look on their faces. These men, to look at their faces, they were pale, they were drawn. All they wanted to do is find a cot and lie down and sleep forever and ever. Instead, we opened that curtain and they came through. The dogs started barking. The balloons began to fly. Everyone was screaming, welcome home, welcome home. You will never forget the look on their faces. It gave them joy. It made them, they were alive all over again. Mm-hmm. My country welcomed me home. So that was a great day for everybody, including the band, because they spent X number of days in Hawaii. And by the way, they didn't pay any more money. I saw to it. No money was paid from the military or the United States government other than what was already out there because I had it arranged so that the band would be able to stay in empty barracks, so no cost of money there. Per diem is always in the structure anyway. And then as far as buses and transportation and everything else, that was already there. So therefore, no extra money. Hooray, we won. Red, white, and blue.
A live band all the way from Military City, USA.
That's exactly right. Well said. Well said.
Fantastic. Well, you did mention about how your family has a tradition of practicing and medicine and healing and caring for others. And I know that your aunt, Dr. Margaret Pittman, your father's sister, was also quite renowned. She was internationally respected for her research in the field of microbiology and immunology, and her work was instrumental in the protection of children from whooping cough. Can you say more about her influence on you and the important lessons that she taught you?
Yes, indeed. I should mention both sisters, though.
Yes.
There was one was Mary Helen Pittman. That was her sister and my father's sister. And Mary Helen Pittman was a nurse from Cornell University. She was the longest living live member of the American Red Cross. She died until she was 99 years old, and she was still a part of the Red Cross. But she did not go overseas during World War II. She was in America, but she was helping to take care of our national disasters in the United States of America. Every time there was a storm, every time there was a tornado, every time you had anything that was a flood, et cetera, she was there. And so she was remarkable. And then when she finally came to a time when she would not be doing running all over the United States in her own automobile and making sure everything was just right with the national disaster, well, then she was a home attending in regard as a nurse. And I used to go with her sometime to do some of her work, et cetera. And then also she had a place where you brought in children, children that were from poverty-stricken areas or what have you. So she asked me as a young girl myself, probably 12 to 16, to come and I would tell stories to the little children that would come in. And I would play act the stories for them and have them to help play act the story. So that was a lot of fun and made a big difference in a lot of children's lives. She also, in Texas, made sure that she went to the different nursing schools in Texas and made sure that they were up to credibility. She made X number of the Texas nursing schools be very well accredited because she went and managed and made that little magic happen. Then with my Dr. Margaret Pittman, my other aunt, what have you, I used to work with her sometime in the summertime in her up in Washington, D.C. She eventually became a director with the WHO, which was the World Health, and also with the NIH in Washington, D.C. Now, she was known for working with a number of scientists. She worked with Jonas Salk, who was given the honor of bestowing the polio vaccine. She worked with him, but her vaccine was the one that prevented whooping cough, which was a horrible death disease, a death knell to anyone that had it. You literally choked on your own mucus. It was tremendous, horrible death. Well, there were others that worked on the same vaccine or worked on a vaccine, I should say, that was their vaccine. But hers was the one that is ended up using. It's still used today, and it's used all over the world. Mm-hmm. Dr. Margaret Pittman. So from her, though, is I went on a trip with her when I was 16 years old. She invited me to go to Europe with her, whereby they were having the 16th World Microbiology Congress. Well, this is a big deal because I've never been too far out of Texas. So, but I went, I did not wear typical teenage clothes. I wore nice clothes, nothing outlandish, but I just looked a little more professional by wearing a little suit or something, and not like a Texas teenager, as it were. And of course, I had learned manners. So when I went with her, all of the people that we met, they thought that I was a young intern, which meant they paid attention to me. And I had knew enough about medicine from my family, I could really have a good conversation with them because I did know these things. And so it was really fun. And I learned a lot because they thought I was a young intern. They would teach me a lot. These are famous men like Fleming and different people that had big names in certain things. And so it was fun to be with people like that because they're so electric in their personalities. And it was a joy to be with them. And I learned a great deal from them. And also we had an audience, a personal audience with the Pope in Italy, what have you. And that was really very humbling and very delightful to have. So from her on that trip, when I came back home, as I said before, I did not look at the world anymore like my street and my city and my Texas. I looked at it from a global aspect of what's happening here or what's happening in France, what's happening over there. And I think that was a tremendous asset to me as a human being.
Well, I'm going to get you a glass of water. I should have thought of that ahead of time.
Thank you, just to
help you stay hydrated throughout the interview. But my next question is about your relationship with wildlife conservation. You mentioned that that's one of your father's influences, that he taught you about animals. And I know that you've told me a number of really wonderful and entertaining stories about your adventures with animals. What are some of your favorite adventures with animals?
Well, when you have adventures with animals, I must tell you that each one, there's no one or two, each one has its ideal memory with it. But there are two of them that fascinate a lot of people when I share it with them. And that one was with when I was with a lion, the largest lion I had ever seen, and his whiskers were touching my leg. And I spoke to him, and I won't go into the whole story, but it was something that the people that were there with me, was only a guide and a tracker. And they thought that the lion was going to go a certain direction. I knew what the lion was going to do because this is the monarch. This is his home. He's not going to go walk down the river and come up another way. This is where he lives. So I knew what he was going to do, and he did it. And I had my camera just ready to take Time Life magazine picture. Well, I was too close when he came to the area right past me when he was going to pass. I was too close to him. The camera blurred. I couldn't get the picture. The only thing I could do was I said to him, I couldn't help it. It was too wonderful. And I whispered to him and I said, oh, you are so magnificent. And so he stopped when he did that, when I spoke to him, and he looked up at me. Now, you're not supposed to eyeball these animals, what have you, but I do. And he had looked at him, and he looked at me, but you see, he read me. He saw my eyes. He saw that I am no threat. And at the same time, he saw I was not afraid of him. So he just stood there and looked at me a little bit. And when I said, you were so magnificent, he looked up at me and he said, but of course I am, just like a man. And so after that, he passed on, went on and up to get the girls to tell them who were sunbathing, four lionesses, to say it's time to go for dinner. Now, after that happened, there was a silence. And I'm looking around to see the driver, and I'm looking around to see the tracker. And I thought, why are they so silent? And the driver said, and stuttered, he said, I think he liked you. And I saw they had been frightened. They were terrified, but I wasn't. You see, that's the secret. The animal only are going to be upset if they know you're afraid. But if you're not afraid, you become a novelty to them. And they're kind of curious. You have to be careful, but at the same time, and use your wits, but at the same time, they will let you. You can't have a friendship with them, but you can have a relationship with wild animals if you handle yourself correctly. If you think you're going to make them nervous in any way, you just back away. But anyway, I've had some great events because of that, and I talk baby talk to them, which scientists used to tease me about that until one day, because I used to go to Africa every year and help with conservation. So one year I came back and was working with some of the same people that I had worked with before, different scientists. And one came up to me and he said, you know that business of baby talking to the animals? And I said, yes, you know, because they used to tease me about it, laugh about it. He said, and then he whispered, he said, I tried it and I'm waiting. I know what's going to happen next. And he turns to me and he says, it works.
That's a great story.
It is fun.
Well, I know that you are the founder and CEO of Operation Save Earth, and in addition to photographing these wild animals, you also are now writing about some of these experiences and sharing some of the lessons that you learned from your relationship with animals. What's your reason for writing Four-Legged Heroes, the Mama Magina books?
Well, I was really, with what's happening in our world today, seriously, and I've lived long enough to see the changes made. I've been through X number of wars, so I know something about history. I studied history from the past, but I'm living history that's going to be in the future. So consequently, I thought, what can I do? And because I do believe in the Almighty, I said, what can I come up with that I can help children and families to entreat children in a proper way, that they can be guided and they can learn and they do not pick up the horrific situations that are being put out there on TikTok, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it came to me that tapped on my shoulder. It said, you know animals. You know how they work. You know how they think. You know how they take care of their kin. You know their elderly, their young ones, whatever. Use animals. No one can argue with you what you're going to say in animals, because scientists has already proven how animals take care of their kin. And in so doing that, the animals continue to live on because the way they create their family living and how they handled their family living and how they take care of one another. Their species moves on. So I did that. I started talking about, especially the wolves, because children can relate to animals in any all sorts of ways. So can other people. And wolves, we talk about a lot in the United States, and we have wolves in the United States. So I'm thinking, I will use the wolf. So we went ahead and I gave some of my own true stories. And I also began to write the story with that in mind, of giving true stories, three true stories, that one I lived myself with animals, and one that I was telling this great story of 1925, how huskies had saved the whole town of Nome, Alaska, at a time when they were going to be defeated in trying to reach the vaccine in time to Nome, Alaska, because diphtheria kills very quickly. And the only routing they had to get to Nome, Alaska in time, because of the terrible snowstorm and the winds, there was no way other than going by huskies and sled dogs. Well, it took 25 days to do that on a normal run. We didn't have 25 days. Everyone would be dead. The dogs made it in 5.5 days. And this was now a Pony Express relay. But still, each dog from the relay station had to go as fast as they could. They had no time to stop, to rest, to eat. They had to be there X number of hours to get to the next relay station. Well, the humans said, we have to try, because it's human life we're trying to save, especially children in Nome, Alaska, but we definitely are going to be defeated. Aha. They said that, but they forgot to tell the dogs. And the dogs do what they love to do. They love to run, and they are not going to be defeated. They had courage, they had bravery, they had that grit, they had determination, and even the last dog, Balto, who did what he did in 22 hours in the dark, some of the most treacherous land in the United States of America, and that's the Bering Sea up there in Nome, Alaska, what have you. And finally, even his handler gave up. He couldn't handle it anymore. The sled is going up in the air from the wind. The sled is going to be turned over. The dogs are going up with the wind, and they just righted themselves up. Finally, Balto, who was the lead dog, part wolf, what have you, and part dog, husky, and he kept on going. Gesser, who had gave up, he was a handler, he couldn't even handle the sled. He just gave it all to Balto. Balto and the dogs followed Balto, and they arrived at 5:30 a.m. in the morning, so spent, they couldn't even bark. They couldn't make a sound. but the whole town went crazy because the vaccine was actually there and the dogs knew something wonderful had happened. It was one of the greatest American rescues in American history. And our husky dogs embedded with the wolf DNA, they did it.
And out of that came the Iditarod.
That's right, exactly. And so every year we had the Iditarod to honor those dogs and what they had accomplished. Can you even imagine? I get teary-eyed just when I go to even to tell the story, because I know and I've read witnesses and I did a big investigation over the whole thing. And having been a musher myself, I can relate to what all of this really meant at the time. But we did it, the dogs did it. So I have written about that story to embed in children what grit, courage, bravery, determination really means when you make up your mind to do it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, indeed. And I love the passion with which you tell that story, and I could listen to it over and over again, but I'm glad you put it in.
Oh, we may make a movie of it.
I'm glad you put it in a book form for us to be able to read about it. This is our final question. What's one thing that you want to accomplish in your life? How would you like to be remembered?
I really want to know.
That's why I asked.
Well, there are a lot of things that people want to be remembered for, you know, kind duties and certain things like that. So there are really two that I really feel hard about. That the one is, I would like to, when I wake up in the morning, I would like for the devil to say, "Oh hell, she's up." That's number one. That I work on right now. Number two is, I would like to be remembered by people that I've tried to live my life that if you say something bad about me, you have to lie. Mm-hmm. I tried very hard at that because I felt like I needed to be a flagship for my family's legacy, so I had to do it right. But I feel like if there's something I can say or something that I can do or something that I can write that can give a different lens to people to think differently on a higher plane than the way we are living in the world right now. In other words, I would like for people prayerfully to be able to look at me and say, "She lived and loved with pure intent."
And so much passion. And mm-hmm. I enjoy listening to your stories, and I'm glad that we had a chance to share some of them with the rest of the folks who are out there. And
I love to hear your stories too.
I'll have time to share those some other time, but thank you for sharing your stories with us today.
I'm delighted to be here and have the opportunity and to share this kind of history, and I hope it means something to those that listen to it, and I hope it gives them an uplift as well and something to look forward to and live for.
Thank you so much, MVP.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such an opportunity for so many people. This is done so wisely. Much gratitude.